Last week, a mass shooting at a community college in Rosebery, Oregon, reopened the debate about gun control in the United States. The shooter killed at least 10 people, including himself. The topic of mental health came up as part of this discussion, too. The shooter left behind a manifesto. His mother acknowledged that he was troubled.
On Friday, Governor Scott Walker spoke about the shooting and said, "We need to focus on mental health problems instead of gun control when it comes to mass shootings." Our next guest says Governor Walker is right that we need to address the stigma surrounding mental illness, but that he's reinforcing the wrong association between mental illness and gun violence, and that adds to the stigma.
Shel Gross joins us now to talk about the issue. He's director of public policy for Mental Health America of Wisconsin. Shel, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Rob.
I want to start by giving a listen to Last Week Tonight with John Oliver on this topic.
And the aftermath of a mass shooting might actually be the worst time to talk about mental health. Because for the record, the vast majority of mentally ill people are non-violent, and the vast majority of gun violence is committed by non-mentally ill people. In fact, mentally ill people are far likelier to be the victims of violence rather than the perpetrators. So the fact we tend to only discuss mental health in a mass shooting context is deeply misleading.
And Shel, do you feel that after every mass shooting, when this mental health issue comes up, is this a concern you share?
Absolutely. And I think it's one, unfortunately, that really negatively impacts those people who are living with mental illness. One example, it's sort of ironic, is one of the things the governor did as part of his major mental health initiative last session was authorized pilot demonstration programs for peer-run respite, which are, sort of home-like places for people who are experiencing mental health crisis to go. They're actually run by people who have been there, who have had lived experience. But two of the three vendors who the state contracted to do this could not open up because of community opposition, because, of course, they were afraid to have people with mental illness in their neighborhood. So it's not just so much the stigma that leads to this discrimination, which interferes with people then being able to get the sort of help people often want, but then are limited and be able to get.
Why, if the majority of gun violence is committed by people who are not seen as having a mental illness, why do we have this conversation every time we have these shootings?
Sometimes there are some associations. There may be some mental health background. Whether that's pertinent to the particular crime or not isn't always clear. I think part of it is you don't hear stories that say non-mentally ill person commits crime. It's an unsaid thing when that doesn't happen. And there's lots of crime, of course, that just doesn't get reported that happens, in the communities are not mass shootings.
And you point out in a press release the greatest danger when it comes to mental illness and guns is not homicide, it's suicide. So how can we as a society, we as a state government for that matter, start to tackle that problem?
Right. Well, and I'm glad you brought that up because nationally about 60% of gun deaths are suicides. And I believe it's actually higher than that. In Wisconsin. And we know that one of the most effective ways to prevent suicide is to separate people from lethal means. That means do matter when it comes to suicide. And timeliness matters, that people are often suicidal for relatively short periods of time. And so if we can keep them safe during that period of time, we can save lives. And families have often been aware of somebody in crisis. We often think of committing that person, locking them away, but that's a difficult process, and that's a pretty serious restriction of people's civil liberties. But we can institute a process for being able to remove guns from individuals who may not choose to give them up voluntarily, and many people will if asked. If somebody says, "I'm really concerned about you, let's put your gun, let me keep it at my house or a friend's house or whatever, just until things are better with you." But for those people who don't choose to do that, to have a restraining order, a type of law that allows with due process for those guns to be removed is something that I believe the legislature is going to have a chance to look at.
So what would something like that work like, this idea of a lethal violence restraining order in practice, if, say, a family member had a concern like this?
Right. A family, they would contact law enforcement. Law enforcement is familiar with doing these types of restraining orders. They could then interact with with the individual and determine if something should go to a judge for review, at which time if the judge indicated that there was cause. And, you know, there would be specific criteria for when this could happen. They're really based on, you know, the current situation as well as the evidence we know about what poses risk for future violence. So then with the judge's permission, they could remove guns for a short period of time, and then usually these laws have a second review after a number of days for a longer decision about whether there needs to be a longer removal of the weapons.
We're talking to Shel Gross from Mental Health America of Wisconsin. We'll continue the conversation in just a few minutes about how we can address the stigma surrounding mental illness, and we'll get into that stigma a little more and its relationship to gun violence.
We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. How do you think we can break the association between gun violence and mental illness? And what can be done to decrease the stigma that surrounds mental illness? What policy changes would you like to see made? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now about what our guest calls a misleading association between mental illness and gun violence. We have Shel Gross with us from Mental Health America of Wisconsin.
And we're taking your calls. What do you think needs to be done to reduce the stigma that surrounds mental illness? What policy changes related to mental illness do you think could help? And what do you think about the association that's often made between gun violence and mental illness? Call and share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Before we go to your calls, Shel, you mentioned earlier local opposition, a fear of mental clubs for people with mental illness. What can we do at a state level to maybe dial down the stigma, the fear that surrounds mental illness?
Sure. There's actually a proposal that was presented to the Assembly Committee on Mental Health Reform by a group called the Wisconsin Initiative for Stigma Elimination. It's based on the fact that what we know from evidence is the best way to reduce stigma is contact with people who we view as like ourselves, who have a mental illness, and sort of counteract the misconceptions, you know, people have about it. Most people probably work with folks who are struggling with mental illnesses, and they may not know it, but there are people they like and know and see every day. But it's very hard for those people to disclose because of the stigma that exists. And so the proposal was WISE has developed a program to help people think about to whom and when and how they might disclose their mental illness, so that can become more part of the dialogue and people can realize there's this whole range of people living with mental illness, the vast majority of whom are like you and me, getting on with their life, struggling with things in various ways. And it's not like what happened with the LGBT movement, as that more and more people came out, everybody knew people and knew that they knew people who were gay, and they said, oh, he couldn't be gay, I kind of like him. You know, and it's the same thing that can happen. And so there's a proposal that would help support this training, people to do the training, people to support folks who were going through this process.
I want to get to our callers. Shel, Mary is on the line in Milwaukee. Mary, hi.
Hi. I wish I could say that it was just a simple legal process to get someone's gun taken away from them, but I just wanted to briefly tell my experience. I was recently the victim of someone that threatened my life, and it was a very loose association with this person. I wasn't even sure how they actually found me. And I went through all the proper legal proceedings with filing restraining orders, but this person couldn't be found. So they never got their paperwork served, and they never appeared in court, and my case was dismissed. So I don't think, unfortunately, going through legal channels is the way to have this alleviated. I do believe it is a mental and a criminal situation, and that should be addressed.
Mary, thanks for the call. Shel, maybe a difficulty with this idea of a temporary restraining order removing guns from a dangerous situation.
Certainly that's an example where this wouldn't have helped, but I think that there are many situations where it, you know, there is somebody to be served and from whom the weapon can be removed.
All right, Mary, thanks and good luck. Sorry about that happening to you. Sarah is with us next in Oak Creek. Sarah, hi.
Hi. Yes, I have some serious mental illness problems, and it has rendered me disabled. I can't hold a job anymore. We need parity with insurance. I'm on Social Security disability, and I have Medicare. My psychiatrist and my therapist are retiring. and I can't find somebody in my area that will take Medicare.
Sarah, thank you so much. And again, sorry about your story. Shell, how are we doing on access to mental health treatment, affordable mental health treatment in Wisconsin?
Yeah, and that's a good point. When the caller says we need parity, we technically, legally now have parity in health insurance, where insurers are supposed to provide mental health and substance abuse in the same way they provide everything else. The problem is we think there's still a lack of parity in terms of approving services, so sometimes there are stricter criteria for people to be able to access those services. And I think what the caller brought up is, in many parts of the state, we really have a workforce issue. We know with psychiatrists, we are well below the number of psychiatrists we need to be able to serve our population. And in areas of the state, that's true for other mental health services. So, you know, even though we have this legal thing about parity, we have a long way to go to make that real for people like the caller.
Sarah, good luck to you. We'll go next to Dan in Rice Lake. Dan, hi, you're on the air.
Calling me.
Go ahead, Dan.
I think that your guest's proposal doesn't stand a tinker's dam's worth of a chance in front of the National Rifle Association, and I say that because I'm a lifetime member of the National Rifle Association. They are intransigent, and if you had the law written to take a gun, temporarily remove firearms from somebody who was absolutely conclusively proven to be a raving maniac, the National Rifle Association would absolutely resist that idea.
Dan, very briefly, would you support a law like that?
I would suggest as an alternative, we should amend the Second Amendment to add the phrase, while serving on active duty in the militia.
Dan, thanks for your call. That's probably a little above your pay grade there, Shell. But as we wrap up, do you think, given the conversations that are getting out there, that John Oliver clip we played earlier, people are at least starting to talk with this idea of an undue stigma of mental illness?
Well, I think there's certainly been a lot more discussion about it. You know, the question is just, you know, where it goes over time, and doing some of the things like making sure there are adequate treatment services, you know, delinking this idea, you know, the violence and mental health stuff. We've made some progress. We still have a long way to go. And I think we have to talk about these issues in order for that to happen. So I appreciate you giving us the time to do that.
And Shell, thank you for joining us today. That was Shell Gross, Director of Public Policy at Mental Health America of Wisconsin. He joins us to talk about how Wisconsin can address mental illness stigma and the issue of gun violence.
Leaders of the United States Department of Agriculture and the Environmental Protection Agency recently came together to announce an ambitious goal for the country to reduce the amount of food waste by 50% by the year 2030.
It's the first time the government has introduced a food waste reduction target here in the U.S., and it's happening because we throw out a lot of food. The government estimates that we waste about 31% of our food supply in the United States. Other reports suggest that numbers are even higher. So how do we start turning that around? And is it realistic to think we can cut that level of food waste by half in just 15 years?
Here with us now to try and answer these questions is Jonathan Bloom. He's a journalist and the author of American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It. Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a pretty significant goal here from the EPA and the USDA to cut the amount of food we waste in half, by 50%, that is, in 15 years. What was your first reaction to that, Jonathan?
I was impressed. It is a rather aggressive goal. I wasn't expecting it to be 50%. So that was my first reaction. And then since that time, I've started to wonder a bit about the specifics.
And what do we know about the specifics? I mean, with a goal like that, you got to have a plan. So what do we know about the plan?
Yeah, well, I'm still waiting to hear the plan. And so there's been a little disappointment on my end as to how we're going to reach that goal and what the specific steps are, but also where the funding will come from in order to enact some, hopefully many of the changes that might lead to less food waste in America.
Well, you've written a book on this. You're an expert. So if you were writing that plan, what would you have people do to get to that 50% cut?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'd establish a firm baseline measure. You can't really know if you've reached a goal until you know what you're measuring that progress against. So I haven't seen anything on that end. But after you create that baseline goal, I'd love to see a bit more funding and policy to tackle the food waste issue. In particular, the farm level and the household level are the areas where the most food waste comes from. So targeting those two sectors of the food chain would make the most sense. And, of course, enlisting help from food industry insiders wherever possible. So grocery stores are part of the solution, or can be part of the solution, whereas now they're part of the problem. So, yeah, in terms of specifics, I'd love to see a national landfill food waste ban, but making it illegal to throw away food waste. And I believe that one single step would have a dramatic impact on how we approach food at all levels of the food chain.
And I want to get back to that, but first I want to talk about the role in the federal government. They're the ones putting this out there, the EPA and the USDA. What do you think about the role of the federal government in calling for a reduction like this in food waste?
I definitely think there's a role for government in reducing food waste, and setting a goal is a nice starting point, but here's where the difficult work starts. And so coming up with a plan, I believe, is real leadership, as opposed to just setting a goal and putting it out there. And so what I call on in that opinion is looking at history and looking how in the 1990s the USDA had a National Food Waste Reduction Coordinator, and they had some plans and some policies in place to try to reduce food waste. And at present, there isn't one person in the federal apparatus whose role it is to focus on food waste.
So do you see that changing maybe if there is some money specifically allocated to this initiative? Do you think there need to be people in the federal government who specialize in just this one area?
Well, I think it couldn't hurt. I think having something like a food waste czar, as I called for in my book a few years back, I think that would really help dramatically. And simply rounding up all the willing participants and calling on all of the various federal agencies to play their part in the solution, that would have a major impact, in addition to letting the market and private industry play a role as well.
Now, you said that, in your estimation, having a landfill food waste ban could be the single most significant thing that we could do to cut down on food waste. How would that work?
Well, so Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Vermont have all set these state bans on landfill food waste, and they all vary in the details. But Vermont's actually is the one that I would emulate, in that it applies to not just commercial food waste, but household food waste as well. And basically says we have to find a solution other than throwing away this food. So the first step there is to try to reduce the amount of wasted food we're creating. And after that, trying to find a good home for excess food through donations to nonprofit organizations, feeding hungry people. And then if we can't do that, feeding livestock, creating usable proteins through food waste. Can't do that, then creating energy through anaerobic digestion is the next best step, or composting after that. And so what that one piece of policy would do would be to kickstart all of those areas to provide more emphasis on donation of edible food, obviously getting people to maybe be more wise in their supply and demand equations. And then finally, it would really be an impetus for building up that composting infrastructure, building new facilities, and be a real kickstart for that composting industry.
We're talking with Jonathan Bloom right now. He's the author of American Wasteland. We're talking about a new initiative from the federal government to reduce the amount of food waste in America by 50% in 15 years. And Jonathan, why do you think it is that we waste so much food in this country?
Well, there's several reasons, but primarily it's abundance, beauty, and cost. And so those ABCs of food waste really prompt so much of our food to be wasted, about 40% of available food. Abundance speaks to the fact that we have about twice the amount of needed calories per person per year. And the beauty factor means that we want our food to look perfect. And anything that doesn't look just right, whether it's the wrong shape, size, or color, or certainly if it's started to be less than desirable in terms of being good or not, we're going to cast that aside. And the cost factor, while food prices have been increasing, when you look at the percentage of our household budget that goes toward food, no other nation spends as little on its food supply. And put simply, we don't tend to value what we don't spend much on.
So part of this is raising awareness in the public. And how do you convince people who are used to throwing lots and lots of stuff away, and we live in a package-heavy society, not just a food waste society, how do you convince people to start taking something like food waste seriously?
Yeah, I mean, that's the key question here. And we do live in a throwaway society, and throwing away food is just another indication of that notion. So primarily what I try to do is raise awareness on how much food is being discarded, how much food we are throwing away as individuals. And I find that shedding light on that sheer level of waste and the dollar impact that goes along with that tends to get most folks' attention. Now, ideally, taking into account the ethical and environmental implications of that food waste would be a real motivating factor. And with some folks, certainly it is. But frankly, dollars and cents speak loudly and speak louder than environmental and ethical concerns. So just telling people that they might be throwing away upwards of $2,000 for the average family of four, and that's going to get people's attention, and that's going to drive behavior change.
Well, what kind of behavior changes do we need? So your average family hears that $2,000, and of course, everybody would rather have that in their bank account than in a landfill somewhere, but how do you start to cut down on what you throw away and start saving money?
Yeah, well, primarily it's being a smarter shopper and not buying food waste, essentially, by overbuying. And that might mean going to the store more often, buying less food each time, or if you're going to make that weekly or biweekly shopping run, you have to be really disciplined. You have to plan meals, make a shopping list, and then actually stick to that list when just about everything in the store is pushing you into those impulse buys. And I know that sounds a bit nagging, and no one really wants to do that, but at the same time, we pay such close attention to the sales and the circulars for the supermarkets, but we don't factor in the cost of the food that we're not using. So I think just simply being aware of that is another huge strategy advantage for people to practice at home. And how you come to notice your food waste, I mean, that's not easy because our food waste does tend to just kind of go away. Doesn't really stick around. It's out with the trash or down the disposal. But simply composting or keeping a log of all the food you're throwing away, even if it's for a day or a week, that's going to really shed light on how much food you're throwing away and hence how much money you're wasting.
So this goal of cutting food waste in America by 50% in 15 years, do you think it goes far enough?
I think the current goal is sound. I think if it were more aggressive, it would be completely unreachable given our status quo with food waste. I think it's aggressive enough that it's going to get people's attention, and it's going to communicate that we have to change many of our ways with our food system. So I like it, and I think it's a great starting point, and now the key question is how do we reach that goal? And that's where our focus needs to be on these days.
Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Jonathan Bloom, journalist and author of American Wasteland. He joined us to talk about the EPA and USDA's goal to cut food waste in half by the year 2030.